This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm your host, David Wilk. And today I have, really, for me, it's a great pleasure to be talking to my old friend, David Unowski, who is best known, but not strictly known, as the founder and operator of the Hungry Mind Bookstore in St. Paul, Minnesota. David, how are you?
Great. How are you, David?
I'm good. It's always good to talk to you, and it's actually great to talk to you for this occasion, essentially. I mean, and we've known each other for a really long time. I should point that out to people who are listening. I was, when I lived in St. Paul, I was a close neighbor to the bookstore, and we became good friends pretty a long time ago. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how, I mean, I guess I'm going to assume that not everybody knows what the Hungry Mind was and where you got to be or how you got there. So maybe you could talk a little bit, at least, about how you became involved in the bookstore business.
Yeah, well, I was in the family business, which was wholesale wine and liquor, and we were little, and the other guys were big, so we decided to close it, and this is early 1970. And for whatever reason, and I still don't know what prompted me, I got up one morning and said, aha, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to open a bookstore near McAllister College. Now, McAllister College was for St. Paul, the center of anti-war activity and political left movements of various kinds. Think about 1970, there was an awful war going on. There were people in the streets. There were people getting shot in the streets. The civil rights movement was really deep. The women's movement was building momentum. The gay movement had just pretty much started, at least publicly. And I wanted to be part of it. So I also believe that books can change the world and books can change a person's life. And so I wanted to be in the book business. So I looked for a location near McAllister and lucked into one basically right across the street, which was the first location of Hungry Mind. And I picked that name, which actually I had heard there was an old bookstore in Ottumwa or some town in Iowa that had that name. And I then thought that would be a great name for the bookstore. And opened the bookstore in October of 1970.
So, you're saying you had no background, no experience in the book business before you decided to do this.
That is correct. I had some business experience. I had worked retail, but knew nothing about the book business. Didn't know where to order books from. Didn't know the process at all when I started. I learned by the skin of my teeth or by, you know, the hard way.
So I interrupted you. You were about to talk about
the
beginning of the store.
So we opened the store in October of 1970, and the most of our business was student at the beginning, although the other people who were not students came. In those days, students actually read books and were very politically active, which they may or may not be today. Within 2 months of opening the store, college professors who had been ordering from the college store, which was corporate, started ordering books from us. Obviously, they were partially political, partially tired of the corporate store, and that sort of helped us get going. Learned a little lesson about banks at that time. So we had opened an account at a local bank nearby, and when I got these textbook orders, I needed money to pay for them, so I went to my neighborhood bank. And I asked him if they could lend me $5,000 to buy the books. And he said, well, do you have a financial statement? How long have you been in business? You're showing a profit? I said, been open for 2 months. Of course we're not showing a profit. He said, well, do you have collateral? And I didn't. I had already mortgaged my house to start the store. So he wouldn't look at me. Well, it turned out that the bank that my dad and I had used when we were in the liquor business, I went to see him, and since we had closed the business and paid off all the loans, he said, well, how much do you need? I said, $5,000. He said, I had brought him a one-page thing about what to expect, and he threw it in the drawer and wrote out the check.
Because those days are gone.
It was personal then.
Yeah,
those,
right.
Those days are gone. That's right. So anyhow, we got going, and there was one period in that first year when I wasn't making enough money. I had two little babies at home. I took a job first loading trucks in a liquor warehouse and then working in a liquor store again for about 6 months. And as we approached the end of the first year, so summer of 71, the business was doing enough to support me and the other guy who was working there, and we had other people came and did a few hours here and there, but basically it was a two-person operation. Well, in the fall of 71, McAllister had a falling out with the corporate store that was their textbook store and also the sweatshirts and all that stuff. And so I went to them and I said, hey, there's this empty garage sitting across the street here, and why don't you make us your textbook store? And while you're at it, lend us the money to run it, because we don't have any. And it only took about 2 months, and they came around, and that's what happened. And so the summer of 72, we actually opened the store, which was in the site of where Hungry Mind remained for the next 32 years. I should say also that we did have the first reading in this store. I think it was the fall of 71, and it was probably on Yom Kippur, which I'm ashamed to say I was working. And it was Alvin Greenberg, the late Alvin Greenberg, read from one of his books.
Yeah,
that was the very first reading ever at Hungry Mind.
So,
and yeah.
Do you feel like, we can talk about, you know, what Hungry Mind became as a kind of cultural venue in St. Paul and beyond. But when you first started, did you have a kind of conscious awareness that the store could be this place of community or a place within the community? Did you have any vision of that, or was it simply, hey, it's a cool thing, I want to have a bookstore, and I don't know what it's going to look like?
The latter. It's pretty much, it's a cool thing, and I don't know what it's going to look like. I think the sense of what it could be started to grow, and it took a couple of years really for me to start getting a vision of what a bookstore really could be, and also to recognize that there were people like me doing this all over the country.
Right. And that's I think that's important, that you were part of this kind of upwelling of interest in bookselling that really did grow organically. It wasn't like a whole bunch of people were writing about it or talking about it. There were so many people doing what you were doing in so many parts of the country, but independently of each other for such a long period of time.
Right. That's pretty much started in the 70s, maybe the very late 60s. And there was great bookstores arose in Denver and Iowa City and the Bay Area and Boston and Cambridge and
Austin, Texas.
Yeah. And they really each started on their own. And it was only later that there sort of became this community of us.
So did you, through the 70s, business obviously grew substantially. Was there sort of a continuum, or can you identify periods in the store's growth, like the first 10 years or the first 5 years? Does it sort of work that way, or was it all kind of just a continuous organic growth?
Well, the first 5 years, the growth was slow. When we became the McAllister Bookstore, and that was a big bump, and I suddenly had 10 people working instead of two. But that, for the most part, for the next 3-4 years, textbooks was the bulk of the business. As community started finding out about us, and we started reaching out to the community. I think a big part of the where it started jumping was when Jim Sitter came to work for me as a student, and we started doing readings. Jim, as you know, was head of the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses, recently won the K. Sexton Award here for service to the book community. And he was the one who actually started the reading series, which really was one of the hallmarks of Hungry Mind, you know, over the course of which we had 8 Nobel winners and about 100 winners of Pulitzer and Man Booker and similar awards come read at the store. So that was a big one, and it was the late 70s when that started taking effect and the growth really started happening.
And wasn't, I mean, there was a period of time, maybe that was the 80s and 90s, but when you had, I think you had events in the store just about every day of the year.
Yeah, it was from the late 80s to the 90s for sure. Actually, 95 was the prime year of all time when it was our 25th anniversary. And by that time, publishers knew who we were, and the Twin Cities was no longer flyover country. And we got every author we asked for, pretty much, for the anniversary year.
Yeah.
And I had John Updike, and I had Barbara Kingsolver, and I had Studs Terkel, and I also was working with offsite partners, and I had Neil Simon and Kirk Douglas, and you name it, we got them that year. But that was probably the peak. Now, as we grew, there were obviously competition. So the main competition when we started, as far as chains, was B. Dalton. But I never felt like they really impeded us in the sense that we were reaching a different market, and not much happened until they bought Pickwick. I don't know if you remember that, but Pickwick was a California chain that was a discounter. And so B. Dalton, which was owned by Dayton Hudson, bought Pickwick, and they started opening these discount bookstores in the early 80s. This is parallel to the time that Crown Books was doing discounting around the country.
Yes, I remember that.
And in fact, one of those years in the early 80s was the only year in the first 30 years of it that our sales didn't go up. And then they found that model wasn't sustainable, and they closed it. And I admit to dancing in the street in front of the B. Dalton in Highland.
So just, you know, this may be like technical, but, you know, I am kind of interested how the mechanics worked for you in those early years when you were a new store. Did you buy most of the books from publishers? Did you work with wholesalers? I know there were in those days, I remember there being local wholesalers, local what they called IDs, where you could get magazines, the independent distributors who were basically localized distributors of magazines. I assume you had to work with all these different suppliers to get books.
Yes, we started out, and the main supplier was Bookman in Minneapolis, which was Norton Stillman and Ned Waldman's wholesale company, started in the mid-60s. And we got magazines from Gopher News, as I remember, although later on magazines became a bigger factor as other magazine jobbers appeared. But yeah, the local magazine jobber was Gopher News, and we got the magazines from them. It was only in the late 70s, it probably took 6 or 7 years before we started really ordering much from publishers other than textbooks. And then, but by the end of the 70s, all the sales reps from the publishers and the commission reps were all calling on our store. So then we were buying from Random House and all the rest of the publishers. And then, as you well know, since you were one of the founders of the small press distribution business, we bought from you and then from Bookslinger.
Yep, I do remember that. And, you know, and Minnesota became this kind of focal point for so much of independent publishing. It was really an ecosystem there that I think had a lot to do with the Hungry Mind. You know, that's what, you know, led to Sitter becoming involved in the book business. And then he, you know, his involvement led to other things happening, which included attracting some of the independent publishers to actually move to the Twin Cities. And this kind of community developed there, which I do think is a unique development. I don't think that happened anywhere else. I know it happened in the Bay Area, but in a different way. But I think in the Twin Cities, the way it worked was somewhat different than anywhere else.
Right. It really did work, and it worked because partially just because of the right people happening to be there and to work together or separately or together to do things that led to that. It also happened because the foundations here, and Sitter was part of helping make that happen, the foundations recognized that literature was a fundable and nonprofit literature was important and deserved to get grants just like theater and graphic arts, et cetera. So the McKnight Foundation and the Bush Foundation gave huge amounts of money to help bring Grey Wolf and Coffee House here and to help Milkweed start and to help the Center for Book Arts. All of that nonprofit stuff really developed partially because of the help from those foundations. It also happened because you and your ex-wife had the book fair at the Small Press Book Fair, which brought a lot of people here, and Sitter was here, and I was here, and other people all worked to make this happen.
Do you think, I have always thought, and I was not a native to the Twin Cities, so I kind of
right.
can't be sure that my understanding is accurate. But it felt like because Minneapolis-St. Paul is this cultural center for so many people in the Midwest, that people who moved there because it was a hub of activity that they were interested in valued it in a way that may not have been true in other places. That, you know, it's, I don't want to overplay that, but I wonder if you agree that the importance was highlighted by the fact that the Midwest does not have that strong sense of being a cultural center, the way San Francisco kind of takes that for granted, New York takes it for granted, but the Twin Cities values it because it's so special.
Well, I think you're right, although it's interesting that it's the Twin Cities and not Chicago, which is much bigger, and not St. Louis or other Midwest cities. So there's something special here that contributed to that feeling.
That's true. Well, it may be because Chicago is so big, so geographically diverse, it's harder to have a focused community, whereas the Twin Cities, not as big, maybe easier for there to be a completely shared, I mean, even though it is still geographical, I know there were people in St. Paul who probably never set foot in Minneapolis and vice versa, but still more of a sense of shared community there. And it's also easier to get around. I mean, from one end of Chicago to the other might be an hour. From one end of the Twin Cities to the other might be 40 minutes or a half an hour. So although maybe the traffic now is worse, I don't know.
Right, it's getting there. It's getting worse, but it's doable. It's, you know, and I also think that as far as the arts community, I don't think that people in the arts community really are the ones who said, I never go to Minneapolis or I never go to St. Paul. Hungry Mind had a huge audience from all over the Twin Cities, and people had to learn how to come to St. Paul.
Well, maybe because that may have to do with the events, you know, that if you want to hear Mary Carr, let's say, and she's at your store, that will get people out of their couches and into the store.
Right.
If you talk to people in the book business now, they say that, author events are not as effective or not as popular as they used to be. You know, so clearly we have a change in the culture that's occurred over the last 20 years that's probably made things more, you couldn't do what you did then. I don't think you could do it today.
I'm not so sure that's true. I think author events are different. In this town, there's two or three author events every night.
Wow.
A lot of them are local. A lot of them are not in bookstores. They're in bars. They're in churches. They're in community centers. They're every possible place you can imagine. Yes, it's true that the market for the major touring authors has changed, although we have programs here where people pay $35 to $50 to see authors, and they fill the auditorium. We also have the public, Minnesota Public Radio does their events at the Fitzgerald Theater, made famous by Garrison Keillor, and they fill that too. So I think it still works here for the most part.
Do you think there are not as many events as there used to be, or is it actually still pretty vibrant?
No, I think that we're not. The publishers are not touring as many authors as they used to, the major publishers.
Right.
But in terms of actual events, I say there's more events here than I've ever seen.
Wow.
You know, you have an event and you say, well, where's everybody? And then you look at the, it's the Rain Taxi Review Literary Calendar, and it turns out there were six events that night.
Right.
And you got 25 or 30 people. And
right.
That's pretty good when there's six events.
Right, because you're splitting that audience up six ways instead of two ways or something like that.
Exactly.
Well, let's go back a little bit to the history of the Hungry Mind, just to kind of get there, because I think there's more that we can talk about. But so the store, you also became interested in publishing, not just book selling. You maybe want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, yes, actually, in the early to middle 80s, we started the Hungry Mind Review. And it was started by me and Bart Schneider, who was a playwright and writer who actually came here from the Bay Area, and he's back there now with a little publishing company. And so we started that, and we got a little tiny little grant from a local arts agency before we did the first edition, just based on Hungry Mind's name, which helped us get started. And we basically gave it free to independent bookstores around the country. And we built that review into something that got some national attention, and in a very perverse way, like, people in the Twin Cities still had at that point the little inferiority complex, like, well, Hungry Mind's a good bookstore, but, you know, it's just our local bookstore. And then when people nationally started talking about the Hungry Mind review, George Will wrote about it, and Kevin Costner used it in a movie, and there was some mention of it in the New York Times a couple of times. Suddenly, people realized not only what a good review it is, but that Hungry Mind was a nationally known bookstore, too. So it redounded that way. But anyway, we started the magazine with three or four times a year with mostly local writers and some art, and then it got bigger. Actually, the greatest article, in my opinion, well, there are several great editions. One was the one we did on race, which we got a huge grant from the Bremer Foundation. And then the interview we did with Michael Chabon and Neil Gaiman about genre, in which they both said, there's no such thing, sort of, or we don't care about it, we just write what we feel like, was also one of the great pieces ever done. This started in the mid-80s. Then in 92, we started the Hungry Mind Book Publishing Company with some outside partners. And we started, mostly we did, well, the first book we did was appropriately called Leaving New York. And it was a collection of essays and poems and songs about how when you are an artist, a writer, a chef, whatever, in America, you want to go to New York because that's the big city and that's where you need to be. And then so many people go there and then they say, God, I don't want to be here. And they leave. And then they leave and then they miss it. So there's a collection of pieces like all about that whole process, and included Willie Morris writing about when he got fired at Harper's by somebody from Minneapolis, the publisher of the Star Tribune, who also owned Harper's Magazine, and some great poetry, and the Dave Frischberg song, Do You Miss New York, and the quote from Billie Holiday, I'm on the 27th floor of the city I both hate and adore. It was a fun book. That was the first book we published, and then we went on to publish, I think it was about 150 books. A lot of them were reprints. Some were translations that we got from overseas. Some were rights we bought of other books. And I was happy to say that we published Bill McKibben, who is one of the leading people in the environmental movement today, published Mona Simpson, published Pat Conroy, not Pat Conroy, blanket on his name. He was at Iowa at the Writers' Workshop.
Frank Conroy.
Frank Conroy, yeah. So, you know, it was great fun while it lasted, and it lasted about 7 or 8 years. The review actually lasted beyond the life of the bookstore.
And when did the bookstore close?
Bookstore closed on July 1st of 2004. The last scheduled author before that was Robert Bly, who read on the 25th of June. And though we actually had a reading after the store closed because we had scheduled it, and it was three writers who had been published in Best Music Writing of 2003 or 2004. And so we had an event, even though the store was closed. But the store was closed in 2004. And we tried everything to save it. We had an auction. People and writers donated things. We had a stock sale. We raised about $300,000. It was a sale in which people, if we didn't make our goal, which was $600,000, people got their money back, and we didn't get there, except that a guy came forward who had a couple million, and he said, I'll put up all the money, and I don't want to do the stock sale. So we scrapped the stock sale, and we thought we were going forward, and we had a lease negotiated with McAllister, and at the end of the day, they backed out.
And that's what ended it, essentially?
Right.
And so, in other words, because you couldn't you couldn't be the McAllister bookstore, your investor couldn't go forward.
Well, they were our landlord.
Right.
And and we owed them money. So we would have had to start over again, basically, and the investor didn't want to do that, and that was the end of it. Right. You know, it was a long, slow decline, though, and I think that opening the store in Minneapolis was a part of it.
We didn't talk about that you opened a satellite store in the Minnesota Center for the Book, right?
Yeah, yes. The building's called the Open Book, and it had the Minnesota Center for Book Arts. It had Milkweed and the Loft all in that building. It was a very unique thing. They raised $8 million, I believe, to buy this old warehouse building and retrofit it to fit what's in there now. And corporate donations and foundation donations and personal donations. And I was part of the fundraising too. And then we opened a second Hungry Mind in that building in early 2000, I believe. But it drained a lot of money, and that, and I think internet and our failure to respond in a way that would have been better helped grease the skids, you know. Yeah.
Well, but in some, you know, sometimes it's hard to know how much of it is when things end like that, how much of it is what you could do to change it, or what were changing conditions. You know, it's just really difficult to say, I think, in circumstances
right.
like that. One tends to think it's all one's own fault. But I think there's, you know, the farther you get away from it in time, it probably makes it easier to see it more clearly. But you never know.
Yeah, well, I understand the conditions, but I am a person who always thinks, well, if I would have made the right decision, we'd still be there or whatever. But I don't beat myself over the head about it. And the other thing is, for most of 34 years, I couldn't wait to get to work every day. And if I loved it that much. If you got that, then regardless of the final outcome, that's a great thing.
Yeah, I think no one would disagree with that. I think that if you can get up every day and want to go to work for 30 years, that's pretty good. And you've stayed involved in books and publishing ever since. So it's not like, you know, I mean, it's just like a transformation into another phase of being involved in the things that you love to do.
Right. I still, you know, I worked in two different bookstores after that and helped them start their author events at Majors and Quinn and Subtext. And now I work with the St. Paul Almanac, which is a great local publication. And I do this counseling at Springboard for the Arts. And I have some private clients. And as well as working on the grocery store.
And like full circle, right? You go back to your roots.
And the liquor store. Yep.
Right. Yep. So in the time that Hungry Mind, one of the things I've thought about is that a lot of people that worked at the Hungry Mind bookstore are still involved in the book business in lots of different ways. Do you keep track of the, you know, the veterans of the Hungry Mind who have moved on to other things?
Yeah, well, last week I was awarded the Pat Bell Award by the Midwest Independent Publishers Association, and one of the things they cite in that award is mentoring. And so after a great introduction by local book writer Marianne Grossman, I talked about mentoring and how we need to mentor new generations of independent publishers and booksellers. And I talked about how so many of the people who worked for me at Hungry Mind and people I worked with later are there. They're in they're publishers, they're writers, they're booksellers, they're book designers, they're arts administrators, they're editors at many of the presses and the bookstores that you can hardly go to one today, 13 years after Hungry Mind closed, without running into somebody. And they're also in the Bay Area, they're in Seattle, they're in Portland, they're in Baltimore, they're in New England. So, yes, and yes, on Facebook, many of us still respond to each other's stuff. Somebody tried to do a Hungry Mind group, and it didn't really work, but there's probably 40 or 50 of us who are on Facebook and are responding to each other's stuff, whether it's career changes or pictures of our kid or our cat.
That's pretty good. That's a form of community in the current age, I think, that's hard to argue with. It's, you know, it's pretty nice to be able to see the people that you knew once, and remain in contact with them through that method. Through that means.
I've seen about six of them in the last week too. Also, yeah.
So, you know, when you look back on, you know, maybe this is where we could talk about a little bit about the kind of sociology, and this is all amateur sociology, of course. But, you know, what's your sense of how that period, you know, because the Hungry Mind's period of existence does cover a period that I think is very important, which is these, you know, that 1970s and beyond period of this kind of organic growth of an industry in a way, a business. I never really thought of it. I mean, it didn't intend to be that, but independent bookstores, independent publishers, authors, all kind of coming up together in a way from the culture and creating a kind of extension of their beliefs and understanding of how the world works through the medium of the book. And I wonder if you agree with me about that and, you know, what your perspective is about that.
Well, I agree with you, and I talk about this a lot, and I think that, you know, a lot of us were there because of our view of the world and shared values and shared interests and shared political view, and that independent bookstores and independent publishers, particularly in the 70s, were the people who spoke out against the status quo and in favor of social change and did it through books and through establishing, you know, what they call the third place, or places where people can come and meet and talk and find people of similar interests and talk about books and talk about ideas. And I also think that as the when we got to the 90s and the chains got bigger and then Amazon came and the independents were sort of headed downward, I think that affected the world. I think there weren't as many ideas for people to look at. There weren't places for them to gather. And I'm happy to say that bookstores now are back on the rise. I don't remember what the latest number is, but American Booksellers Association said the last I saw was something like 400 more independent bookstore members than there were in 2011. And I think that's a great thing. And I think that, I said this 30 years ago too, that sometime in the future, while I'm still alive, there will be a rebirth of independent bookstores. And like when we did it, we were people who, you know, people were doing macrame and tie-dye stuff and had bookstores, and that the new generation will be smarter business people than we are, and they'll be doing other stuff, and that now that we got coffee shops with them and other things. But I just think it's so important that to have this, to have independent bookstores and independent publishers as an independent counterweight and a voice against what is now such the conglomeratized media.
Well, I think I don't think it's possible to disagree. Well, no, I will take that back. I'm sure there are people who disagree, but I happen to agree with you that we need more diversity of voices, and we need more community-driven perspectives, so that it's not all about corporate culture, a corporate created and managed culture. But it does seem harder to do that now than it did 40 years ago. You know, if you compare today to what was going on in the 70s, which was an extension of the 60s, you know, that it just seemed that, for instance, it was possible for someone like you and many other people like you to start a store simply because it seemed like a really appropriate, you know, good thing to do. Today, you wouldn't be able to walk into a bank and say, you know, I need a few thousand dollars. First of all, you'd need more than a few thousand. Second of all, they right. wouldn't give it to you. Now, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe there are equivalents today, but it does seem that it's more difficult.
You're right. As I said, the ones who are doing it are smarter business people than I was. But also, you know, what I realized, even though I had a great bookstore, I also needed to sell other things. So we sold school supplies, and we sold cards, and we sold calendars. And now bookstores are selling way more other things than games and toys and whatever, because that's what you need to do to make a business, because half of the books in America are sold online. Although in the world as a whole, only 10% of retail is online.
Right.
So 90% is still in walk-in bricks and mortar stores in the world. Not of books, but of everything. So, yeah, it may be difficult, but it's certainly doable. And that's why, as I said, there's new stores all the time.
Well, and you also, I think you hit on something early when you were doing this, like Cramer Books. I think Cramer Books and afterwards in D.C. was, I think, the first bookstore that had food in the same place. I there may have been somebody else, but I think they're the ones who established that idea. And you did eventually
right.
Have a restaurant as part of the Hungry Mind operation. And I think that's another form of community that, you know, it made sense to have coffee or food, you know. And if you go into a store like RJ Julia's today, Roxanne Cody's store, the restaurant is a really integral part of the business. You know, if you go and you want a table, they'll say, well, we don't have a table. Why don't you go in the store and, you know, we'll call your name when it's time. And, you know, it's integrated into the experience. But food, breaking bread together, drinking coffee together, that's a place of community, the same way that a bookstore can be.
Oh, I agree. Drinking wine, too, by the way. But, yeah, I did not actually own the restaurant. I knew that I didn't know anything about owning a restaurant. I had two guys who wanted to do it, and I basically made it possible, and it would really work perfectly when the table of contents opened, and I'd say it was 1991. They did great because our customers knew about it, and they brought new customers, and indeed, while they were waiting, they were browsing in the bookstore. We stayed open till 11 at night because the restaurant was drawing people and did business the whole time. So, yeah, it's a great combination to be. There's still people I see today who talk about going to the Table of Contents restaurant for Sunday brunch and then coming to Hungry Mind and buying the New York Times and sitting and schmoozing around and buying a few books. And what a great experience it was.
Yeah. Well, now, who came up with the name Table of Contents? That's got to be one of the best namings that I can think of.
It was a conversation I had with them, and I'm not sure if it was me or Jim Dunn, who was one of the founders there, who came up with that. I'll take credit.
Well, no one's here to argue with you, so you can have the credit for that one. But I love names like that that are really good, that have resonant in the playing of words. I think that's, and it's appropriate. If you're going to have a bookstore, you should have a name that has literary, of anything you do needs to have some literary connotation, I think.
Yep.
So
yeah, it worked like a charm.
Well, so in terms of Hungry Mind Press, what happened to all those books? Did they just did you sell that to somebody else, or did they just get released into the wild, essentially?
They got released into the wild. So a lot of the books, you know, if they're reprints, the author had the rights went back to the author. If we bought it from a publisher, then I don't know who's got the rights. Probably the author, but some of them just disappeared. I know that we actually shipped. We had a book by Clark Blaze and Bahati Mukherjee, the late great Bahati Mukherjee, I might add,
which we shipped to their house somewhere.
Yeah. She passed away early this year. And then there's one book we published, which is a biography of a local black woman activist, Nellie Stone Johnson, and it went to the school that was named after her. But frankly, I don't know if where all the books are. There might still be books somewhere. And I think that some remainder dealers bought some of them. I think Denny Majors bought some of them, who I went to work for a year later. But I don't really know what happened.
Do you ever miss being a book publisher?
Not as much as I miss being a bookseller.
Do you think it's
as much as I miss having a bookstore?
Yeah. Do you miss? I mean, for you, it seems like the connection with people coming into the store—that kind of the social part of bookselling was really important to you.
Yes. Talking with people, knowing what they want, there was a period when I could buy a book from a publisher. This was early on before the store got big. And in my mind, I knew which customer would want it. That's personal bookselling at its most intense. You know, I'd look at this book and I'd say, aha, so-and-so is going to want this book. And when it came in and he walked in, I had put it in his hand. And of course he wanted it. But, oh, yes, and just the whole process of being there and seeing the look on people's face, which you don't get to see it online, you know, seeing the look on people's face when they stumble on a book that they didn't know existed and that basically jumps out into their hand. There's nothing like it.
Yeah, well, I think that probably is a motivator for most people in bookselling, that it is that ability to make someone, you know, to help someone potentially change their lives, certainly,
right.
Offer them some change in outlook or some ability to see something they couldn't have seen before, just to have the pleasure of reading. I think librarians are motivated in that way too, that it's that the very personal experience of exchanging, handing somebody a book and feeling like you have actually affected them in some way, which I think publishers are motivated by a similar desire, but it's less specific, because when you're a publisher, you don't really ever know who reads the book.
Right. Well, I always thought that publishers and editors should make more frequent visits to independent bookstores to sort of get a sense of what it's like in there and watch customers to see what they're doing and get a better sense of what kind of books people are grabbing and not just get that from their computer.
Oh yeah. Well, I think you and I agree about that. I think that there are some people, you know, I know some people in publishing actually specifically go work in bookstores at Christmas and other times like that for just that reason, that it's not only because they want to see what people are buying, but they also love that experience of connecting books with people and seeing and feeling that experience more. But I think it's good advice for anybody in any business to be honest with you. I think that's that level of alienation between someone who makes something and the person that consumes it that's a problem in our society today.
Right. I totally agree with you that the people who make it don't see the people who buy it, and there's something missing there.
Yeah. Well, and also even that the people who connect the object, whatever it is, if it's a book or it could even be a pair of shoes, that they don't have a direct relationship with the people who actually then make the object in any way is also a difficulty, you know, on some level. That chain of this, what we call the supply chain now, I mean, there's the level of where things are. It's called the supply chain. It's not called anything like, oh, I, you know, this is the guy I buy my shoes from. It's a supply chain.
Right. Well, that's why I love going to the farmer's market.
Yeah.
Because I can buy it right from the person who grew it and picked it.
Yeah.
And that's why I love going to local potter shows where I can buy it. I'm a sucker for pottery. I can buy it from the potter, you know?
No, I think that's right.
It means a lot. Yeah.
It does mean a lot. Actually, thinking of that, there's a wonderful bookseller who I think you know, Susie Staubach, who ran the University of Connecticut bookstore for many, many years, and who is, in fact, a phenomenal potter and has written books about pottery. I don't know why that made me think of her. But, I think that connection between the physical object and the person who consumes it is really one of the strengths of an independent bookstore that can't be matched.
Yeah, when you talk about Susie Staubach, I don't know if anyone that you've interviewed had talked about this. We had a group called the Independent Booksellers Consortium, and we limited it to 25 bookstores from around the country. We'd meet two or three times a year just to share stories, to socialize, but also to, you know, help each other think of ways to be better booksellers. And I learned a lot from that group, and I thank them for having me in it. And I think it's still going.
I remember that.
You might want to check on that.
I will. I think I remember that organization because of you being in it in part. But didn't you also do something with Remainder Books together?
We tried to do that, but I don't think it developed very far.
Right.
But we were going to do Remainders. We were going to do like, you know, how you get the cheap editions of Dickens and all that stuff. We were going to have our own imprint for that, but I might have left before that happened, and I don't know if it ever really happened. But Susie Staubach was one of the members, and Fran Kilty, who you probably know.
Yep, I certainly do.
And well, Harvard Bookstore.
Right. I will ask around to see if it still exists, because a lot of those people still are in the book business. I know Susie's no longer in bookselling,
right,
but
well,
Fran is, and certainly Harvard Bookstore is still going strong. Now, do you ever stop in and visit bookstores, you know, when you're in other places and say hello to people that you knew?
I can't go to a town without going to the bookstore. Not this year, but last winter I was in Tucson, and I went up to Phoenix to visit Changing Hands.
Yep.
Which are great folks. I really liked them a lot. They weren't there when I got there, but I did communicate with them about their store and their new store. And I pretty much any town I go to, I have to go in the bookstore. I always, you know, I still hang sometimes with Jim Harris from Prairie Lights, so. And we go to the ball game in Cedar Rapids, but I always make sure to go to Prairie Lights. And, of course, I go to all the local bookstores. But even small-town Minnesota, if there's a bookstore, I have to go there. My sweetheart and I were just in Buffalo, Minnesota. Went in the bookstore to see what they were doing. And they had a nice little coffee shop. And it was a treat to visit there. And there was somewhere we went where we saw a bookstore and yarn store together.
Yeah.
And she worked, Susan works in a yarn store, so it's a perfect visit for us.
Well, it's true. I think that in many smaller towns, what the store that sells books will also be a store of other things, what they used to call notions back in the 19th century. Yeah. You know, the idea that, you know, it might be too small a town for just books. I went to a bookstore in a very tiny town in Maine called Lubeck, which is the easternmost town in North America, in the United States. And yeah. There's a store there called Northern Tides that sells books, but also sells local pottery, local jams and jellies, things, you know, and 'cause it's a coastal town, you know, they sell other things relating to the fishing business and stuff. But I thought, you know, that's really kind of where things may end up, where you might have a store now that will be more than a bookstore. It has to be more.
Well, one of the good old ones of that was Freddy's Feed and Read.
I remember that. Yes.
It was a natural food store and a bookstore.
Right.
In northern Minnesota, there was one called Pastica's Furniture and Books.
Well, and there's one called something in Suds, you know, beer, and it's like yeah. it's a beer and books or something, you know. So
okay. Yeah.
Why not? Well, it
exactly
is
exactly why not. Yeah.
And so it is kind of fun to be a bookstore tourist, I think, especially for people like you and me who have been in a lot of bookstores. It's fun to visit and see how they look, in what ways they differ from what we're used to, and in what ways they're still the same.
Right. Yeah, well, they're different, but they are the same. You know? And the other thing is, I can't go in a bookstore without re-alphabetizing the shelf if it's out of its order. I'm sure it's an OCD.
Right.
Some kind, but.
Do they get mad at you when they see you shelving their store?
Well, they think I'm an author trying to face my book
right.
out.
Yeah. Right. That's authors do that in almost every bookstore in America, right?
Yep.
It's like, my book should be face out, not spine out. Oh, that's great. Well, David, I really appreciate your talking to me. I think, it's fun for me. It's always fun for me to talk to you about anything, but books are great.
Likewise.
And,
yeah.
You know, of course, we could always talk about baseball, but we'll save that for another occasion since this is a book-related podcast.
Right.
But thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and it's been fun.
This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host.